from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Monday morning, and I believe it is June 8th, 2020, and we have a good show lined up for you this morning. We're going to be speaking first off with Tim Ash. He is the president pro tem of the Vermont Senate and checks in with us from time to time to fill us in on legislative doings. And I have a feeling we might get into a couple of other topics this morning, too, given the flow of news over this past weekend here in Vermont and around the country. In the second half hour, I want to open the phone lines this morning and let listeners weigh in, whatever's on your minds. Saw an awful lot of traffic online over the weekend about the big, huge demonstration yesterday in Montpelier, and as well as the overall picture out there in our country right now. Obviously, an awful lot of concern and upset and worry about many, many things, including, of course, the problem of police violence, particularly that directed at racial minorities in America, as well as the problem of the still continuing coronavirus crisis, which really has not gone away, threatens all the time to flare up, has flared up in places like, for example, Winooski, Vermont. And we may talk about that a little bit this morning as well. Later on, we're going to be checking in with some folks in the lodging industry, Jim O'Reilly of the Wildflower Inn up in Linden, the Moose Metal Lodge's Willie Docto, and also Amy Spear from the Vermont Chamber of Commerce is going to be joining us to talk about, is the lodging industry ready to turn a corner in Vermont? Obviously, a very important part of our economy. The governor, of course, announced on Friday a little bit of loosening of restrictions of folks coming in from out of state. And so I'm going to ask these folks if that's going to help, et cetera. So that should be an interesting conversation as well. But let's start off right off with Senator Tim Ash of Chittenden County. He is on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Senator. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning, David.
And so let's start out with just a sort of a recap of why don't you give us your version of the latest news from the Senate and the legislature. What have you been working on in recent days and what's coming up this week?
Well, I think the most critical thing we've been working on is working with the governor's economic recovery package so we can get as many dollars out the door as quickly as possible. And, you know, in normal times, the process to decide how to spend $1 million would take 4 months. And in this case, the question was how to distribute $400 million, and we've had about a week and a half. So I expect that tomorrow the Senate will move the first bunch of grant money out the door to support businesses, especially those who were told they had to close during the crisis. The total is about $70 million is what we're looking at. These would be grants administered by the tax department. And a second bill or second portion will be moving forward with some immediate housing money to purchase and renovate some facilities for long-term housing of homeless individuals. And people might say, well, okay, how does that fit into, you know, the long-term recovery of the state? And the truth is we spend many millions each year paying for hotels and motels for homeless individuals. And we have no real ability to offer services to get them back on their feet, self-sufficient. So by creating these permanent facilities with services built in, it should reduce cost to the taxpayer over time. So it's a good investment to make now. So those are the two key pieces. And then, of course, and I'm sure we'll talk about some reforms around how we do law enforcement in Vermont are also going to be hotly discussed this week.
Yeah, I want to get into that in just a couple of minutes, but continuing on the financial theme for a moment. Meanwhile, the House looks like it's moving toward a bridge budget that would be level funded. Does that seem like a good approach?
I do think so. And, you know, what it does is says we have so much that we're going to learn in the next 2 months. So let's kind of keep things stable until mid-August, when we get the latest revenue updates, and then let's make whatever big decisions are really required when we have the full information. And unless people think it's completely holding the line, we are saying that no non-essential hiring will occur. a lot of discretionary spending is being held back so that we're kind of, you know, holding fire to save it for the big budget in August.
And the let's go to the sort of law enforcement reform issue here. I mean, I wondered how the legislature would tackle obviously this huge concern out there these days about policing, particularly as it affects people of color and so on. Tell me your thoughts about what might develop here in our legislature in Vermont.
Well, it's you know, in some ways, from a legislative point of view, we had some efforts underway which speak to these broader concerns that have culminated in these massive protests. And I think there's a handful of strategies. One, I think we want to make sure that we are coming up with a firm policy on the use of force and the use of deadly force. That includes chokeholds, when officers can use what's clearly identified as deadly force, under what scenarios. These are things that, you know, many departments have internal policies around, but in terms of a statewide accountable policy that basically protects law enforcement and gives confidence to the public, I think that's something that we can work on very quickly. The other is body cameras. We had passed legislation requiring state police to have body cameras, again, to protect both the law enforcement officer and the individuals on the other side of the interaction. So there's a, you know, physical record of what actually transpires instead of two sides, you know, claiming the truth. The administration did not go forward with actually purchasing the body cameras that we required and came up with a bunch of reasons that have subsequently fallen by the wayside. But we want to make sure those get funded this year. And then also, we got to move forward with some model policies to try to de-escalate wherever possible. And that doesn't just speak to the issue of police engagement with people of color and other disadvantaged communities, but also in situations where there's mental health challenges. We've had a number of scenarios or incidents over the last few years where individuals going through acute mental health episodes have had you know, violent encounters with law enforcement. And unquestionably, it's a very, very difficult task we've assigned our law enforcement. They've become everything from police officers to mental health counselors to social workers. It's a lot to ask of a police officer. So I think coming up with some training and policies to really strive towards a de-escalation model is really, really important.
Do you think that we need to move toward a more professionalized police training? In other words, you know, to work as a state social worker, I understand you need at least a bachelor's degree to be a police officer in Vermont. I believe I think it's less than a year of training. I don't remember the exact number, but at the police academy, is that the right balance?
Well, you know, it's I think if we said, you know, is it realistic to believe that people who may wish to become police officers are going to, you know, become masters in social work? I think that that's probably unrealistic, just like it would be unrealistic to ask every mental health worker to be trained in firearm usage and, you know, driving cars in high speed chases. So it's really about making sure that our law enforcement officers working alongside our human services professionals throughout the state, that we have a really integrated approach so that we're asking the right person to do the right work given the circumstances that they're facing. I think that it's very easy in theory to say that, you know, before you can become a police officer, you have to have, you know, 2 years of this kind of education or that. The problem then is you may have no police officers, and that would not be a practical solution. So I think that the real opportunity here is to unite the law enforcement and human services professionals so that they're working in tandem. And I think that's the practical approach that Vermont's got to look at.
And talk to me a little bit. I mean, just to pursue this point a little more. obviously, typically they come from a different approach, really philosophically. I don't know, culturally. How do you actually make that work in terms of a partnership between, you know, a law enforcement posture and a purely human services posture?
Well, the good news is we already have some very good examples to build from. There are several state police barracks who have embedded mental health counselors who work at the local mental health agencies, so that when there's a 911 call and it's clear that there's a mental health situation at the other end of the line, the mental health counselor is actually right there with the state police when they show up on the call. That way, you don't have to confront a person who's going through a very difficult moment with the full getup of a police officer, but it could be someone who is 100% trained in trying to address someone's acute mental health challenge, de-escalate the situation, quickly communicate in a trusted way, and settle things down for the best outcome for all involved, including the law enforcement officers. So we do have some really positive models to build from. I know that in Chittenden County, about 5 communities have funded mental health workers for the same reason, because cops were bringing people into custody late at night, and they quickly realized that it wasn't that the person was intending to commit crimes, it's that they had mental health challenges. And they didn't know where to bring them, because there was really nowhere to go. And so they funded mental health professionals to be an auxiliary force to the police officers for exactly the same reason that the state police have done so. So we do have this model, and I do think it really builds on the best of what Vermont's about, which is getting people to partner together to produce a better result than they could do alone.
Let's go to the sort of reaction here to the situation nationally. There was this really large protest in Montpelier yesterday, by all accounts not as large as the Women's March on January 21st of 2017, the day after President Trump's inauguration, but still one of the larger crowds that I think we in recent memory to show up on the State House lawn and surrounding parts of Montpelier. And first, I guess I should ask, were you there?
I was not. I was at the rally in Battery Park a week ago, and it was very powerful. You know, the not only was it totally peaceful, but you saw people, you know, basically from age 2 to age 80, people, every race that lives in Vermont was there. It was an atmosphere, obviously, that was very emotional and passionate, but there was also an element of sort of a positive vision of reform that was in the air. And I know that yesterday the same spirit was largely captured in Montpelier. So it's an amazing outpouring of emotion and call for action.
Quite a bit of criticism online directed at you know, people who are frankly skeptical, I think, of this whole protest movement, mainly trying to raise this issue of, gee, we locked everybody down for the coronavirus, and now folks are, yes, they were wearing masks, but there were a lot of very short 6 feet distances yesterday. And I mean, do you see that? Do you think that they have a point, or do you think that's just sort of being snarky, or what's your take on that?
Well,
critique,
obviously,
common. I'm seeing it all over the place.
Yeah, obviously, from a public health point of view, the protests present a very serious challenge. You know, just before I got on the air, hearing that New York plans to test 35,000 people a day, largely because of the protests, you know, it does create this secondary problem. But honestly, I feel like, while it's fair to say that any gathering where you're not social distancing presents public health challenges, and that is worrisome, and people should be encouraged to follow the guidelines, I don't think people should use that as an excuse to avoid the larger national discussion that's going on. And it's easy to say, oh, in Vermont, why are we talking about this? The, you know, number of people of color is relatively small. This is for large cities that have lots of crime. You know, it's easy to sort of, you know, snark your way out of responsibility for your participation in the national discussion. So while it is fair to say people should be social distancing, even when they're in public spaces, don't do it as a way of avoiding this larger, important conversation, which has to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the other way to look at this is that, you know, there are many, many times in American history when Americans have willingly gone into very risky environments. And here I'm thinking about various wars and stuff, even gone into very risky environments in the name of protecting freedom or justice or et cetera. And so for the you know, the idea that that people would turn out and perhaps raise their level of risk to some degree in this kind of a situation here, I guess is you know, not completely surprising and not really completely out of character either, is it?
Well, I think there's a group psychology going on, and people have been pent up for 2.5 months now, and then they see, you know, the murder of an individual in police custody, and you know, people are still people, and there's a boiling point, and as I say, you know, adhering to the public health guidelines is really critical. Obviously, watching, you know, 100,000 people in D.C. shoulder to shoulder on hot days is not ideal from a public health point of view. But for those who, you know, rightly are concerned about what that means for COVID, that's its own issue. And then it's time to then talk about the actual problem that people are out there wanting to confront. And it is very easy to find excuses to avoid conversations about our national.
right. I wanted to mention, of course, we do like to get calls from our listeners. 244-1777 is the local number in Waterbury. The toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255. And my guest is Tim Ash. He's the Senate President Pro Tem of the Vermont Senate. We're talking about a wide range of issues this morning. And I do believe we have a listener on the line. Paul from Moncton is calling in. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Dave. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning.
I've been listening to the conversation, and I think you possibly might be missing some of the point of the conversation that has occurred on Facebook and other social media about the protesters for the case of George Floyd being killed and racism, all of which is a very worthy discussion in terms of having the protest and everything. I think the issue with some people, or I didn't even say the majority, who look at those protests is not so much that what the protesters are doing as much as how the government responded and how the media responded, as opposed to those who went out to protest the shutdown of our government, of our country for such a long time, economically speaking, and the pain they were feeling and suffering, and the fact that they thought it was a constitutional issue also. And I did see some that were directed at the protests themselves, which I immediately tried to dismiss and take out of the picture because I disagree with them. But I think that the media response and the government response to two different groups has been absolutely 180 degrees difference in terms of how they approached it.
180 degrees different. Tim Ash, what do you think? Is that a legitimate observation there?
Well, I think, you know, there's certainly truth in that observation from Paul. The nature of protests, you know, means that things can kind of break one of two ways. When management by law enforcement and public officials of a protest is clearly communicated, peacefully oriented, you often see people have, there's more space between people, provides more safety in general for everybody. When there's a militaristic approach to addressing protest, it escalates both sides. We've seen this all through U.S. history. And so in that sense, when there's barricades being put up and tanks rumbling through and cops encircling, protesters, both sides escalate their behavior, kind of crunch together, and you just see all sorts of outcomes that are really can be tragic and are definitely unfortunate. So
may I ask a question, Tim?
You're absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah. No, the question being, when you talk about the militaristic approach, are you speaking to both cases of those who were responding to the shutdown of the government and to those of the protesters? And did the militaristic approach in either case occur before there was destruction, rioting, looting on either, you know, protest?
Well, Paul, for me, when I'm referring to the militaristic approach, I'm talking about the use by public officials and law enforcement of crowd control. I think that the individuals in some states who were protesting the shutdown behaved in ways that I find actually a real problem for our country. When you've got in the state of Michigan, these pseudo militia men showing up with firearms and clearly trying to intimidate people in the public, including lawmakers and the governor, with weapons. I don't care if it's their right to bring them into the state house, which is its own concern, but the fact that they would do it is sort of somehow an avoidance of trying to be persuasive with your words. So I don't see the two as I'm not referring to both. I'm really talking about the use by law enforcement and the military and public officials of strong tactics before a crowd has gotten out of control, which then leads both sides to escalate.
Okay, well, thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks for taking the call, Dave.
Okay, thanks for the call, Paul. Tim Ash, you know, I want to get back to this question, though, about the sort of policing in Vermont and the concerns raised by the ACLU and others about some cases in which it is reported that you know, minority or racial minorities are treated differently. I mean, there are statistics that show up. I remember a few years ago there was a report indicating that if you were, in fact, I wrote it for the AP, if you were a black driver in Vermont and you were pulled over by state police, you were five times as likely to have your car searched than if you were a white driver who was pulled over. And if you and meanwhile, the instances of the percentage of stops in which contraband was actually found were higher for white drivers than for black drivers. And does that sound like a problem to you? Do you think the state is taking sufficient steps to address it? And if not, what should the legislature or any other public officials do about it?
Well, I mean, of course, it's a problem, and you've nailed it. I don't remember the percentage increases based on what the color of your skin was, but certainly, if you were a black or Hispanic driver, the chances that you're being pulled over are much, much greater than white drivers. And basically, I mean, if you talk to almost any person of color in the state of Vermont, they will tell you that they can't recall how many times they've been pulled over, usually with no consequence because they can't understand why they were pulled over in the first place. And I can tell you, I can't recall ever feeling like I was going to get pulled over because I was a white driver. And what we've done is required every law enforcement agency to provide the racial data for their traffic stops so that we can be monitoring this better. And then when we see outlier departments, go in and try to work with them to figure out what's at the root of it. The whole concept of implicit bias is that the officer isn't conscientiously pulling people over because of the color of their skin, but there's something deeper rooted, which is resulting in that. So I think we have a long way to go. And the story you wrote for the AP, I mean, one of the takeaways from that is that if you're a driver of color, you almost are certain you're going to get pulled over at one point for whatever reason. If you're a white driver, you basically have to drive over someone's front lawn, take out a couple mailboxes, and, you know, set off a sprinkler system. And that's the reason why so many of the white drivers, when they're pulled over, they find contraband. It's because it's really hard to get pulled over if you're a white driver. Whereas because it's so easy to get pulled over as a person of color, most times there's nothing actually going on that justifies the stop, at least from a drug or alcohol point of view.
Do you sense, I will say, I left the AP at the end of 2016, beginning of 2017. In the intervening years, I mean, it's been 3.5 years, and I think that story actually appeared probably half a year earlier. So it's about 4 years ago, actually, I think that story ran. Have we improved or have we gotten worse or how are we doing?
First off, your memory is very good. I'm very impressed. I'm not sure I would weigh in on whether we've improved. What I'll say is that our awareness of the problem has improved. Our requirement that officers are trained as they become certified and recertified so that they are challenging themselves to understand why they're making the decisions they're making and to really confront when they're being relicensed or recertified these questions of race and gender and, you know, the kinds of things that motivate our behaviors, whether we're conscious of it or not. So those are all improvements and things to build on. And I think that's really the key from my point of view. We have, you know, a few dozen law enforcement agencies around the state. We know that not every one of them is, you know, we're not looking at a profession where it's 100% bad apples. There's just like every other profession, there are some people who are bad apples, and then there are many who are really conscientious and do a wonderful job. So what we're doing is really talking about reforms to bring out the best of our law enforcement agencies and to basically drive all the officers towards our best officers in terms of behavior, training, understanding of social problems, and ability to manage really difficult situations. And it is an amazingly hard job, and we have layered so much more on our police officers. And so it is not good enough to complain about them, although there are legitimate complaints in some instances. What we have to do is now figure out what we're going to do about it. And so this week, Senate and House committees will be sort of evaluating where we're at and some additional measures we can take to help make sure that our system is one we're proud of.
All right. Well, Senator Tim Ash of Chittenden County, the Senate President Pro Tem, I thank you very much for joining me this morning. It's always good talking with you. Let's do it again soon.
Okay. Thanks a lot, David.
All righty. We are heading into our bottom of the hour break on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. And just got a few seconds here. I will remind folks that we are expecting another news conference with the governor just after 11 o'clock, governor and other top state officials, and we'll be carrying that live on WDEV FM and AM. The COVID-19 crisis continues. It's not going away, folks, so be careful, etc. Let's go to that bottom of the hour break, and we'll be back very shortly.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Going to open the phone lines this next 25 or 30 minutes or whatever it is we have left before 10 o'clock this morning, and I invite listeners to call in and tell us what's on your minds. Obviously, an awful lot of concerns going on out there. We had this long-running story of the coronavirus underlying all of basically daily life here in the United States of America. That crisis has not gone away. And in fact, I remember just a little over a week ago, I had Tracy Dolan, the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health, on basically telling folks, remain vigilant, continue to care about this as you cared about it back in March and April. And because this virus doesn't want to just disappear, as the president said it would. It turns out it really wants to pop up wherever it is given an opportunity to do so. We do have an outbreak underway, apparently, in Winooski, Vermont, and we are obviously state health officials are very concerned about that and trying to contain it, working hard to limit the impact as much as they can. And then meanwhile, we had And a lot of people are saying that coronavirus is kind of a the tinder or the kindling or whatever, and that and then we have this flashpoint of the police killing in Minneapolis of this the George Floyd and in Louisville, Kentucky of Breonna Taylor. The these incidents have been the spark, I guess, to really light a fire nationwide. Maybe that's the wrong metaphor here, but there's just been this outpouring of angst and anger and upset by folks. Obviously, very upset about this these acts of violence by police. Who I think in I don't think there's anybody, including many most responsible people in law enforcement, who believe those actions were correct or responsible or anything like it. So this outpouring into the streets of America now going on, and I've been seeing a lot of discussion, sort of a heightened fervor on Twitter and Facebook over the weekend about a lot of these issues. Some folks are trying to conflate the two or link the two. The coronavirus, you know, why are people allowed to go to demonstrations when we're supposed to be social distancing, seems to be one favorite question I see popping up. So I'm interested in getting the thoughts of our listeners out there. Is that a reasonable question, or are there explanations which easily should put it aside? Meanwhile, we have this push now on in some quarters around the country to really change up the way we do law enforcement. In Minneapolis, the city council, the majority of the city council, apparently wants to disband the police department and create something completely new as far as what would be providing public safety for the largest city in Minnesota. And I'm curious to know what folks think here. Should we completely redesign our police departments in some places to really try to change the culture, change the structure, change their relationships with our communities, should the police get tougher, as the president seems to want them to do? He was out last week calling for the governors to send people into the streets of America and dominate the protesters, the president has shown a great deal of impatience for this kind of activism. At one point, he said a couple of years ago, I guess, when the police arrest people, quote unquote, don't be too nice. So definitely a different approach. I'm curious to know our listeners out there, do you have a preference there? Do you think that president is on to something? Should we send in troops? Last week there was a big controversy. The New York Times had a column by Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas calling for basically backing the president, and who said he might have to bring in U.S. military troops, I guess, to do battle against U.S. citizens in our cities. And the senator from Arkansas wrote this column saying, yeah, the headline was actually "Send in the Troops." The New York Times later concluded that it had rushed that column into print, that it did not meet the paper's standards for accuracy. Now, many on the conservative front are saying that the Times is showing its left liberal stripes by backing down from publishing that column. The New York Times is saying that actually it's not less about the politics than about getting the facts right. So, which they're saying this column didn't completely do. Anyway, let's take a call from Rama from Williamstown. Good morning, Rama.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, listen, now people got to understand. I'm going to make a couple points here. And this comes from the point of view of somebody who is not I'm just not against police simply because they're police. And just as example, several years ago, a sheriff's deputy was chasing somebody right past our house here on a back road in Williamstown. And then we watched that happen. And then a few minutes later, along came the guy the sheriff's deputy had been chasing, and there was no sheriff's deputy behind him. I went out and did a big circle around the block to make sure that the sheriff's deputy was okay out there. you know, that he wasn't sitting on the side of the road injured or hurt or anything like that. I am not against police. On the other hand, there are a lot of people who join police departments because they are of an authoritarian mind bent. And to them, the use of violence is a good thing, and they're perfectly happy to do it. We don't get to know how many, what the percentage is. We don't get to know if that's 5%, 1%, 90%, 50%, because over time, we've never, as a society, been allowed to really dive in and investigate the police, exactly what they're doing on a day-to-day basis, what the complaints are, we're just totally blocked out of it. And it's all hidden behind various laws or labor contracts, et cetera. One of the things that they're all missing down in Montpelier is responsibility, individual personal responsibility on the part of the person who wants to be a police officer, and openness to the public so we can get some of that sunshine disinfectant in there and we can know if our local police department is filled with good people or it's filled with bad people or what the mix is. We don't get to know any of this right now. And none of the approaches, none of the things that Ash was talking about a little while ago come close to, you know, telling us what is going on with our police departments.
Well, I think that, Rami, you raised some troubling questions here and certainly something for people to chew on. I don't know exactly how you govern against. I mean, is there a personality profile test that needs to happen? Is there, I don't know, some sort
open
of
open it up. Just when people make complaints, stop hiding complaints. You know, let's even start with that. Stop hiding complaints from public view. Stop hiding what kind of action was taken against a police officer if a complaint was found to be valid, et cetera, or not valid. Because this way, I mean, look at the guy who murdered that gentleman over in Minneapolis, right? I mean, he had a long list of complaints. Most of them got clear. He got cleared of. Yet here we watched him willfully, deliberately, putting his nail. What he was doing to that man's neck, that stuff I learned in MP school years ago. And then we were told that there was a couple years later that you could not use it because putting pressure on a person's carotid arteries or choking off and putting them in, you know, choking off oxygen to the brain, et cetera, that can kill a person. You know, everybody knew.
Yeah.
And that racist pig that was sitting on top of that poor guy's neck with his knee, while he was doing that with his hands in his pocket, just looking down at the guy like, isn't this kind of cute and funny? You know, this should not be stuff that is allowed to go on and happen. But it's allowed to happen because between what the police push, pandering by politicians, and a willingness of folks who do not bear the brunt of this violence. And yes, right now the topic is the violence of the police against our black brothers and sisters. I don't disagree with that. But I can also find you plenty of white people, and we have examples of that in Vermont, who have had very rough handling, undeserved, at the hands of police simply because they could do it. And I've watched it happen. So we know it happened. So let's put some sunshine on the issue, among other things. Let's restrict what the police can do to us, because the police are supposed to be protect and defend, not jump on us. You know, they become more of an occupying force over time. But
let me ask you, Rama, maybe, I'm not sure you're the right guy to ask, but this question pops into my head, so I'm going to put it to you. Second-degree murder is to the current charge against Chauvin, Derek Chauvin, the officer involved in this, primary actor here, I guess. And usually that involves, second degree usually involves a lack of premeditation. If you're on somebody's neck for 8 minutes and 40 something seconds, could you call the first 4 minutes premeditation?
Beyond a shadow of a doubt. If I react the way the laws on premeditation are written, if I did that and I wasn't not being a police officer, that would be premeditated because there was a second there was several seconds between the time when I could stop, think about what I was doing, and take the action that I took. There is not a shadow of a doubt what happened was premeditated murder.
Never mind several seconds. We're talking several minutes.
No, I understand. That's why I'm saying it's several seconds. Several seconds for me.
Yeah.
And they would have me for premeditated murder because I had a chance to stop, think about what I was doing, and then I continued doing what I was doing. So that's the whole point. Him doing it for minutes and with those other three cops just standing around watching or actively assisting, holding the guy down, you know, even when people are sitting there saying you're killing him. And what's the public supposed to do? Are we? And I asked on Twitter, and it's not a facetious question, and it's not, you know, it's not a mean-spirited question, but of the Vermont State Police, if I see a cop in the process of murdering somebody and that cop's in uniform, am I allowed to intervene to save a life, or do I have to sit there and watch a cop murder somebody simply because that cop's in uniform? These are things that we really need to explore. Police are not beaten bad because they're police. Some police are bad because of the type of people they are.
All right. Thanks for the call, Rama. I got to move along. Let's go to Ziggy in Newport.
Good morning, Dave.
Rama
brought up some good points, and you've got to get rid of the bullies somehow. Like, how you do that, I don't know. But you've got to get rid of the bullies. But in this case, in Minnesota, that you're just talking about. The other three officers, from what I understand, they were all brand new guys. They were on some of them were just, they haven't even served a week yet, okay? They had to address this officer as sir, okay? Everything was sir to this guy. So it was kind of like an on-a-job training mission for them. And this guy had issues going back, like you explained. He had issues going back a number of years, back from when Klobuchar was still the attorney general there, okay? So mm-hmm. So what happens there? He's protected by the police union. It's the police union protects people like this. They can't protect the bullies. And when you were speaking with Senator Patrick Leakey on Friday, I wish you would have asked him about that, because you realize that Senator Leakey gets almost, he's the senator I think he gets more money from the police unions than any other senator. I wish you had.
Are you sure about that, Ziggy? Have you looked it up lately?
Huh?
Are you sure about that? Have you looked it up lately?
I have a good feeling. He's up there.
Wait. You have a good feeling, or have you actually checked the facts? Have you done a Google search or any kind of research to back up that claim? Gone to the FEC website to find out what senators get what donations.
Ziggy's household is going to get Wi-Fi'd here in maybe sometime this summer, but at the moment,
okay,
I'm not.
Do you go to the library and look it up?
Hey.
Before you make an assertion like that in public? Or do you just sort of guess at it?
Hey, so another, you talking on Friday with the senator, and you were talking about the police presence on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial.
Lincoln Memorial, yeah.
And they were there because the last weekend was a very violent weekend, and the Lincoln Memorial was defaced with graffiti. That's why they were there. I mean, I don't understand on how Abraham Lincoln's memorial can get defaced in America. It's like history is... This is why I proudly fly Betsy Ross's flag, because to me, I stand up for Betsy Ross. When that Nike thing came out a year ago or whatever, saying that that's a racist thing, a sneaker with the Betsy Ross flag. Betsy Ross, she was an American icon, for Pete's sakes. She stood for woman suffrage. She was against slavery. How do you equate the thing? It's like just history is getting rewritten, and that's the thing that I hate most about this BML movement.
Okay, Ziggy, thanks for the call. I got to move on. Let's go to Gene and Barry. Good morning, Gene.
I think the police try to be judge and jury. I thought police are only supposed to arrest you, right? And it's up to the court. And it's up to the court what that person would be sentenced, you know?
Hello? Yeah, I think you have a good question there. Obviously, I cannot explain what happened certainly in that case of George Floyd in Minneapolis. I mean, that was I don't think anybody can. I think it was a particularly egregious.
The police are supposed to control themselves too, you know.
You would hope so.
Kind of out of control. But I blame a lot of this protesters. You can protest, but you don't have to destroy property.
Right. I agree with that. I don't think there's really any call for
because they're not
vandalism, looting, any of that stuff. But and you know exactly what the cause, the affiliations of the people involved. Hard to know. But,
it's just going to cost people money because probably their taxes will go up too, you know.
Gene, I got to run. I got to go to a break. When we return, we're going to take a couple more calls from listeners. I hope they hang on for a minute while we go to hear some words from our sponsors. We'll be back shortly, folks. More calls coming in. Let's go to Brian in Williamstown. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
Hi. What's on your mind?
I'd just like to agree with the first caller, the second caller there. The police definitely judge and jury. And let's just paint the picture here in Vermont. Say you're driving down the road. You see somebody getting harassed or what you think is harassed by a police officer. And you can pull over, get out of the way, and go over and start filming that. I'm pretty sure here in Vermont, that officer is probably going to be putting you in handcuffs. And I'll listen to your comment.
Okay, well, thanks for the call, Brian. I don't really have much to add or subtract there because I've never had an experience like that. I don't know exactly what I think you're allowed to do that. Actually, I think you are allowed to film from a safe distance. I would assume you can't interfere with what the law enforcement officer is doing, but and that is subject to check, by the way. I would need to double check, but I don't imagine that there's really any bar to a citizen who wants to pull over and make a video in that situation. As long as they don't interfere with the law enforcement officer's work dealing with the driver that's been pulled over. So that is a little bit provisional there, folks. It's one of those as far as I know kind of situations. So if anybody has any really better solid information, any lawyers out there who know the case there, give us a call. Let's go to the hive mind on that one. All right, let's go to Rich from Stowe. Good morning, Rich.
Hey, good morning, Dave. Dave, I was in civil service for 20 years, and I worked in an organization similar to the police department. And we had captains and lieutenants. And when the lower ranks weren't doing what they were supposed to, and the upper chiefs got wind of it, when things got out of hand, they would tell the captains of the house, look, if this continues, your guys are on the line. And that problem went away instantly because no captain is going to risk what he worked for and where he got because his grunts aren't doing the right thing. So why in the police department aren't the captains held responsible, these precinct captains? They have to know what's going on. They have to get wind of who the racists are, who the criminals are. So that's my point is, if we hold the captains accountable, I think this problem will begin to evaporate.
Yeah, Rich, I think you make a really good point, and that is there is a chain of command here. Obviously, the officers involved in the confrontation with George Floyd do report to a commanding officer, who undoubtedly reports to another commanding officer above him or her, and who undoubtedly report, you know, on up the chain, exactly. right up to the city's civilian leadership. And I do think that there is some responsibility here which goes up the chain. And I think it's a particularly egregious problem, frankly, right here, because apparently there were several prior complaints about alleged misconduct by the officer who was kneeling on Floyd's neck, this Chauvin guy, right. Why those problems weren't corrected prior to this, I have no idea. I think we have a real problem there, and now it's gone to the extreme of actually saying let's disband the police department and rebuild some other kind of public safety system in Minneapolis. That's pretty extraordinary, and that is something that is a pretty strong step, I would say. But there you go.
Yeah, I agree.
Rich, I gotta head into a break here, but I thank you very much for the call. Stay in touch. I appreciate new callers checking in with us from time to time, so that's always a good thing. Alrighty, we are coming fast up onto a break here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. Hey, folks, if you missed part of the show and you want to catch it later, don't forget about our podcast. You can always go to WDEVradio.com, follow the link to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit there, and you will find a list of our recent programs by topic and by guest, and that you can figure out what you want to listen to in what order of priority, etc. Any time of day or night on the internet. There you go. All right, we're going to be back after a break at the top of the hour. Thanks. We'll be back shortly.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We're back, and we're going to continue with open phone lines for the next couple of minutes, and then we're going to be talking to one of our CBS News correspondents, get a report on the global picture concerning the coronavirus. And again, you know, that is something which is still going on here, folks. I think that would be pretty much still our top story here. It's very, very important that people are paying attention and taking the steps they need to stay healthy and stay out of the serious trouble you are in if you catch that thing. That would be our top story, except for this terrible incident in Minneapolis 2 weeks ago today, and the resulting explosion of national outrage, frankly, in the form of protests, some rioting. Let's hear what Fred Newbury has to say. Good morning, Fred.
Hey, very interesting. I think Tom Cotton had a lot of good logic in saying that the National Guard should have gone out when they were needed.
Why were they needed?
Because the rioting was getting out of hand, and the reason why the rioting was getting out of hand because of police brutality, and the rioters were upset with the police, and then who was trying to control the rioters? The police were trying to control the rioters. So if the governor had activated the National Guard as soon as possible, pull the police out of there, the National Guard would have come in, and then there would be no fire thrown into the crowd because there'd be no police there. It was a police riot. And if you had the National Guard there, they would have calmed things down because the people aren't mad at the National Guard.
Yeah, I'm not an expert at these tactics for crowd control, riot control, whatever. But I must say, an awful lot of the energy, especially in places like New York and some of the other cities, seemed to be devoted to police getting after peaceful demonstrators. I mean, I understand if police want to basically, you know, I be stationed along, say, the sidewalks while the marchers, the peaceful protesters are marching down the street, and the police are stationed along the sidewalks and they are guarding against people breaking windows, you know, the few bad actors who want to go and break windows and loot places, that kind of makes sense to me. But I don't understand why there were, you know, reported instances of, for instance, a crowd of peaceful demonstrators who ended up being surrounded by the police and severely, you know, hassled as they actually tried to get done with their demonstration and just go home. You know, people were blocked and as I say, given a lot of grief by the police just on the fact that they had been there, even if they were only holding a sign and walking down the street. And, you know, I wish that more of that law enforcement energy had actually been devoted. And this is a tactical thing. Again, I'm not an expert on these police tactics, but it just common sense just seems to say, you know, why are we devoting really any energy to getting in the faces of people who are there peacefully and not saving your energy for people who are actually, you know, trying to break windows or whatever. So that's what I don't understand. Whether National Guard troops needed to be called in, you know, the president was talking about the U.S. military, which and you know, he got a lot of pushback on that from senior leaders of the U.S. military. You know, please let's not do this.
So the National Guard is military.
Well, that's a debatable point too. I mean, it sort of depends on the degree to which I mean, they can be deputized by the federal government and actually deployed overseas sometimes. As we've seen, you know, often often in Vermont.
As far as the crowd is concerned, if the people that are controlling the riot are wearing police uniforms, they're police. If they're in military uniforms, they're military. You know, that's how you identify them.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, then they have this idea apparently in Washington now where you send out people who are unidentifiable. They have no markings indicating what agency they're with and who they might be, so that if they act badly, there's no accountability. What do you think about that, Fred?
That's not a good idea. I agree with you.
That's called secret police, I think. We don't historically.
Hey, but it was very interesting because back in the early 60s, could have been the 70s, the Japanese were having problems. They had rioting all the time. But the Japanese police knew exactly what they were doing. And that was, you keep the rioters on the move, and you got to push them out of the area that they're in into another area. So you don't want the rioters to congregate. You want them to keep move. And so you just move them away from one area into another area, and you make sure that they're not surrounded. They can always move.
Fred, I got to jump, but thank you for the call. And let's go to CBS News correspondent Pam Falk, who's going to talk to us about the global picture of what's happening with the coronavirus around the world. This is something that is still a big issue in a lot of places and has been bumped a little bit out of our headlines by this the police violence issue in the United States the last couple of weeks. But we need to keep track and pay attention and stay out of harm's way with this coronavirus thing going on, too. So, Pam Falk, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Absolutely, Dave. Yeah, it's certainly not out of the picture. I mean, the only place that has declared it off the boards, coronavirus, that is New Zealand, where they announced today that it was coronavirus free and everybody was back. So that's the only country where it's really off the boards. And in a lot of countries, it's on the rise. Iran today urged citizens to wear masks in public, announced 70 more deaths and 2,000 more cases. And they've already had a significant amount, 8,000 deaths. This is Iran and 173,000 cases. But what you're seeing is places like right after the United States in numbers are Brazil, where it's surging, and it's surging so much that they have stopped sending the numbers out because they're getting such criticism because Bolsonaro, the president, said, oh, don't worry about it, we'll be fine. And you know that in some of the very poor neighborhoods in Rio and Sao Paulo, that the population is just so densely located in the favelas, the poor neighborhoods, that they do have a big problem. And then Russia is right behind it. UK still has a lot. And in India, we're starting to hear where it sounded very low for a while. People were very skeptical about the numbers. But all of a sudden, Mumbai is just unbelievably high. And it's a very densely populated city also. So you're seeing it around the world. It, even in the United States, the idea is keep your masks on. It may surge again. The UN has warned of a second wave because the poorer countries, and ironically, Dave, the countries that are out of touch with the rest of the world, the more remote places, are now getting it. They didn't get it because they're not as global as some of the bigger cities in the world. So they're getting it, and then the idea is if flights resume and people start traveling again, that you could see a second wave in the United States. So it's still a big issue. And, of course, all of the mayors and governors are saying because protests that can't come at the same time and may in many ways link because of just frustration of African-American and Latino communities where there's been an inordinate amount of impact of coronavirus and the economic impact that because the protests because of the protests there may be a surge. So New York governor said anyone who's been in the protest should be tested, and they're trying to encourage people in protests, supportive of the protests, but saying keep your masks on when you protest. So it's really a crazy time in the United States, and people are still very wary about getting back to work. I mean, not back to work. We're all working, but get back to going into the office.
Yeah, and I mean that has got to be a concern right now in the United States with all of these protests going on, and it's tough to maintain social distancing when you're marching down the street, shoulder to shoulder with your fellow protesters.
Exactly.
Boy, my tongue is a bit tied this morning.
Right,
I guess,
exactly, but and also in interactions with police. I mean, you know, all of that means that you're interacting with another individual and scuffling around. So, part of the issue is, look, all any kind of mass gathering is going to mean people infected. So, all the governors are saying, look, protest, but try to stay distant and keep your masks on and gloves on, and let's not see a surge, because then you will see more deaths in the United States. So it's not totally down. I mean, you know, the U.S. global deaths, just hit 110,000. I mean, U.S. deaths and global, you know, the mortality is 400,000. So it's still going up. The question is, how much can you, in a rational way, reopen cities? So much is going on around the world also in support of the U.S. protesters. I spoke with UN Undersecretary General just late last week, Phumzile Mlambo-Nuku, who is South African and was part of the anti-apartheid regime, you know, worked with Mandela. And she said, look, you know, the only thing is you've got to have a takeaway. You've got to have a way where racial tension in the United States is resolved, where people feel like this isn't going to be something policing that affects so many African Americans. And so you're seeing a lot of support around the world and protests around the world. South Africa this morning has a great deal, and so does England, including throwing colonial remnants in water. So there's a lot of almost Tea Party stuff around the world, and then, of course, protests in Africa and Europe in support of the U.S. And so all of that overlaps with the idea that people don't want the coronavirus to keep surging.
Yeah, it's a tough situation where I think...
separate issues, yeah.
Yeah, I sort of understand how some people are saying, I will put myself a little more at risk by going to a demonstration, at risk for the coronavirus. I will do that
right.
In defense of justice and freedom.
It was such a horrific video. It was so graphic to see. And people know that this has been an issue for a long time in the United States. And it does, the sector comes together with the fact that Black Americans have had more impact on coronavirus itself and on the economic impact. I mean, there are 42 million Americans out of work, and so that issue is also coming up in Black communities in the United States. So part of the issue is what to do about all of that. And so it comes at the video of George Floyd comes at a time when there's a lot of frustration. And of course, all of this is because it was just such a horrific death. I mean, we all watched it for, over 8 minutes on video. So I think that is a turning point in the United States. It's coming, we've stopped covering it much, but it's certainly coming at the time of U.S. election. And so a lot of issues about what to do next are part of the issue, are at the forefront, on the front burner in the United States right now, and they're not unrelated. So it's really interesting, Dave.
One last question for you, which is since you're covering the international scene, are there international standards for police technique and conduct, et cetera? I mean, I saw a story last week indicating Norway had not had anybody killed by police in more than 10 years. And so and I know that, there are many stories about how, especially in Europe, there are techniques and methods used by police which end up having, frankly, not the really disastrous results that we get way too often in the United States. Is there anybody pushing, on the international scene to say...
There's no international standards except for all general human... I mean, not general, but very specific, but human rights standards. In other words, everyone has a right to life. Everyone has a right to protest. But the UN doesn't really deal with that because it's a club of countries, and so each country makes their own, except when it crosses into universal jurisdiction, meaning where everybody is affected, like human rights and crimes against humanity. So you've heard there's not a standard or a treaty, but you have heard UN officials all around the globe, including the head of UN Women and the Undersecretary General, who I spoke to, talk about the fact that there has to be a reckoning of this kind of violence and racism in the United States, as there is around the world, that this cannot happen. I mean, what she told me was, look, people just don't want to be killed. It's pretty simple. And she was
pretty
part
basic
of the anti-apartheid movement. Yeah, pretty basic, right? So I think this has galvanized a lot of support, and it's coming at a time when people really want to still stay safe and keep seniors safe, where there's more prevalence of the virus. So, the theme still has to be stay safe.
Okay. Well, Pam Falk, I thank you very much for joining us this morning. It's always good talking with you. Let's do it again soon.
Yes, absolutely. Good talking to you, Dave.
I wanted to devote some time on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM to our tourism industry in Vermont. It is such a vital part of our economy, and really is a way that our state presents itself, frankly, to many, many people from other parts of the country, and develops its reputation as a beautiful place and a welcoming place. And in happier times, our tourism industry just plays that key role for us as sort of ambassadors, and plays a key role for us as an economic engine. It's a place where many Vermonters work, and where many Vermonters make their careers in business. And it can be a pretty tough business in terms of just it's a lot of work to run a little country inn, even though a lot of people fantasize about doing it. But it can be we'll talk to some people. How about we get it from them? I'm not the expert here. We have as guests lined up on the program this morning. We have Willie Docto of the Moose Meadow Lodge in Duxbury, and I believe he's on the phone with us. Good morning, Willie.
Hey, good morning, David. How are you?
Thank you very much for joining me. Jim O'Reilly is with the Wildflower Inn over in Linden. And is it Linden or Lindenville, James, Jim? I never quite get this straight.
Yeah, well, it's called Lindenville, even though we're not in the village itself. We're outside of it.
Uh-huh.
The main address, and everybody just calls us Lindenville.
Yep, and I know you got a beautiful spot up there, and you definitely are both of these inns actually are places that attract people from away who come up here, and obviously in most of the time have a lovely time in Vermont and don't have to worry about anything like quarantines or social distancing or any of that stuff. Amy Spear is also on the phone with us. She's vice president for tourism at the Vermont Chamber of Commerce, lives down in Killington, another part of the state that draws an awful lot of visitors. And Amy Spear, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Great, thank you for having me.
I wanted to go to one of our innkeepers here. I guess I'll start with Willie Docto there in Duxbury at the Moose Meadow Lodge. And Willie, give us a little bit of the brief history here of your life and your inn's life since say February or so. Have you been closed for most of the spring?
Yes. Gosh, where do I start? So, March and April are normally our slowest months. And we normally close March and April. So in a way that was good for us. We weren't losing the current guests at the time because we didn't have any, but those are the 2 months we rely on deposits to come in for future dates. So it's been a real struggle. We've had to, instead of taking in reservations in March and April, we were processing thousands of dollars of cancellations and refunds. So
yeah.
it's been a real struggle. I'm just looking at the numbers this morning, and year to date, our revenues are down about 45%. So it's been really difficult.
Jim O'Reilly at the Wildflower Inn up in Lindenville, tell us your story. Closed for most of the spring, and same kind of thing, big dip in revenues?
Yeah, sort of pretty much similar to Willie's experience, although March is usually still a pretty good month for us here, and we ended up closing down, I think it was around the 10th or 11th of March. So we lost, a good 3 weeks there, and then we had this great April gravel road race, Raspatitsa, and that's like an extra, bonus for us in April, and that was canceled. That was a good, $20,000 operation. So yeah, it's been quiet here since. Like Willie, we ended up having a net negative when it comes to cash flow. We also rely mostly in April on advance deposits for the summer and the fall, and we sent out more in return deposits instead. So yeah, financially it's been certainly not a pleasant ride. May, our numbers in May, we usually bring in just over 120,000 in revenue, and we brought in 10. So that's kind of puts you in the big picture.
Yeah, that definitely that makes a difference. Jim, tell me, what do you have there for staff? How many people do you normally have working there?
So, summertime we usually have about 35 to 40. In wintertime we have about 25.
Okay, and have you had to lay people off?
We did, I mean, we laid everybody off on May 10th or 11th. But we did get the PPP, which has been a big help, having that CARES Act option. And so we brought everybody back on. This will be week three that we've brought everybody back on. And, you know, they're doing things that they're not normally doing. Our morning wait staff are all out painting buildings. Our dishwashers are out doing grounds work. So the place is getting spiffed up. It's going to look really nice.
That's happening. A lot of people are doing home projects, so I imagine in projects too. Hey, we need to take a brief bottom of the hour break for just a CBS newsman, a couple words from our sponsors. Let's talk more with my guests, Jim O'Reilly of the Wildflower Inn, Willie Docto of the Moose Meadow Lodge, and Amy Spear of the Vermont Chamber of Commerce. We'll continue our conversation on the other side of the break. Back shortly, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back, and we're talking about the lodging industry in Vermont, and is it now going to turn a corner after this coronavirus crisis has been going on all late winter and spring here in Vermont? My guests are Amy Spear of the Vermont Chamber of Commerce, Willie Docto of the Moose Meadow Lodge in Duxbury, and Jim O'Reilly. He is with the Wildflower Inn up in Lindenville. Willie, let me ask you, what do you have for staff there, and have you had to do layoffs, and has PPP helped? Basically the same questions I was just asking Jim a moment ago.
Sure. So it's just my husband, Greg, and I. Mm-hmm. We are a very small business. But this is our major source of income. So we have four guest rooms in the treehouse. So we don't really have staff. Sometimes we'll hire summer help, but we're definitely not going to be able to do that this summer. But it's just the two of us. So, you know, our risks are lower than, you know, Jim's place where he's got a lot more staff. And so in a sense, that's good. I'm always trying to look at the positive side of things. So,
yep. So you are a little more, I guess, maybe nimble is one way to describe it. But you don't have that. You don't have those issues of worrying about, am I going to be able to pay employees? And you said you have, four rooms plus the treehouse, right? So that's really five accommodations.
Right. So we have 5 units. Yeah, we don't have staff, but we still have fixed expenses. So we just had to pay out last week, you know, our business insurance, which is huge. We've got utilities, internet, phone, you know, everything else that we have a mortgage to pay. So those things don't decrease in accordance to our revenues decreasing. So, you know,
now have you been able to get any, Willie, have you been able to get any coronavirus business aid of any kind? Jim mentioned
so PPP. Since we don't have staff, we did not apply for PPP, but we did apply for the EIDL, the EIDL grant, and we got $2,000. So that's not going to go very far. And so we're hoping that the legislature will quickly pass the governor's economic recovery plan, because those funds are needed by a lot of small businesses in tourism, you know, people like us and Jim.
Let me bring Amy's to the conversation. Amy is with the Vermont Chamber of Commerce, Vice President for Tourism. And, I guess we got disconnected from Amy. We'll try to get her back in just a moment, and because I wanted to sort of get some overall statewide stats and general picture of what's been going on in the lodging industry in Vermont. I mean, Jim O'Reilly, maybe you have a sense of kind of the overall impact here to some extent, running a larger place. I mean, I was saying at the beginning of this, in the intro to this segment, that the lodging industry is big in Vermont. It's it is, you know, maybe outsized compared to just what it would be in kind of the average state. Let me ask Amy this, because I have a feeling she's going to really have a good statewide handle on this. Amy, I wanted to shift gears and talk a little bit about the statewide picture and the overall role of the lodging industry in Vermont's economy. Do you know how many jobs are tied generally, you know, in normal / good times with the lodging industry in Vermont?
So in general, just in the tourism industry as a whole, it's over 30,000 jobs, which is about 10% of Vermont's workforce is in the tourism sector. So that's not a small number at all. It's over 30,000 Vermonters that are being impacted by this in the tourism sector.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was going to be in that realm, and it is a big thing. Do you know, of those roughly 30 or more than 30,000, how many of those folks have been laid off in the last couple of months?
You know, we're tracking that regularly through our Vermont Futures project, and I haven't had a chance to look at this week's dashboard, but you're looking at a significant number of the workforce that's been laid off because, you know, I believe Peter McLaren from West Hill House Bed and Breakfast said it really well a couple weeks ago. You know, when lodging properties are closed, they can't sell the bed and breakfast experience online as a digital experience. So when a lodging property is closed, there's no way to be creative and find a way to get revenue in. So, you know, those that have not been able to take advantage of the PPP loans or idle or others to bring staff on or keep them on, you know, they've been significantly impacted.
And what is your sense now? You know, the governor on Friday announced that there's going to be a little bit of and maybe you can fill me in on the details, somewhat of a relaxation on the restrictions or quarantining requirements, et cetera, for people coming in from out of state. Refresh me on those details, and then we'll talk about how you think that might help the situation.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's no secret that the impacts of COVID-19 have been devastating to the lodging sector. And while the continued gradual reopening is not ideal for the hospitality industry, you know, it's a small step forward that was badly needed that happened. So effective on June 8th, people living in New England or upstate New York are permitted to travel to Vermont now without quarantine restrictions if they're traveling from a county with similar COVID-19 caseloads as Vermont. So that threshold is set at 400 or fewer cases per million, and this is updated weekly on the state's website. So here on the Agency of Commerce and Community Development's website, and you select their cross-state travel information, that's what gets updated every week, and they've got a map there that folks can follow.
So I know the governor's been very concerned about you know what he talks about with surrounding states having much higher numbers of the COVID-19 in recent weeks, and so when you say New England has basically greater and easier access to Vermont, upstate New York as well. But it's different depending on, for instance, which county in like Massachusetts you're from.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a county by county number. So that 400 cases per million is that threshold that they're looking at. So for example, if you look at Suffolk County, which I believe is the one that Boston is in, they've got over 3,000 cases per million. So they're still going to be indicated as a red county. So there are folks, if they live outside of the counties that don't meet the 400 per million threshold, as of June 15th, travelers from counties that do not meet the requirements are permitted to travel over to Vermont with a few restrictions. They can complete a 14-day quarantine, which is, you know, been the status quo with this. But then also they could complete a 7-day quarantine followed by a negative test. The difference here is that now people, as of June 15th, could complete their 14-day quarantine in their home state. and then enter Vermont without further quarantine restrictions if they drive directly from their home. So that is a shift that's happening on June 15th.
The I'm sorry, was that Willie? Go ahead.
Yeah, yep. If you don't mind, I just want to add on to what Amy just said. So this past weekend, I had a string of texts, Facebook texts, with other innkeepers in the state that belonged to an association. And none of us was at all excited about the announcement the governor said last week that 55 counties or residents from 55 counties don't have to quarantine. What he didn't mention, and I know he's going to clarify this morning, was that second part, and that is after June 15th, people can then quarantine at home before they come here, no matter what state they're coming from, no matter what county they're coming from. That is huge for us. That's going to help a lot. However, it may be, you know, coming a little too late. If we had known this maybe 2 weeks ago, people could have planned ahead and did their marketing a little bit better. But it is a good direction that we're heading, so that 6:15 removal of quarantining in Vermont is going to help a lot.
And the current status where you have this sort of selection of counties which are in or out or whatever, Jim O'Reilly from the Wildflower Inn, you were telling me the other day when we spoke that that actually presents some difficulty for you because the counties which are still out, I guess they're over the 400 per million mark, are your primary out-of-state market areas. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I guess baby steps is good that we do have some counties opening up and there are parameters around it, but as far as the lodging industry, at least where I am, it's not really going to help until, you know, our major markets, which is the Boston, Hartford, New York markets, open up and across the border in Quebec. I actually haven't heard any talk about when the, you know, Quebec border might open. That'd be interesting. I wonder if Amy knows anything about that.
Amy, what are you hearing on the Quebec border situation?
Yeah, so right now that it's, you know, closed through the end of June. I do know that our another one of our vice presidents, Chris Kerrigan at the Vermont Chamber, is actively working with our partners on the reopening of the border. So that's something that is being discussed and we're actively working towards on our end.
Yeah, that's a obviously, especially for a northern Vermont property like up in Lindenville, you have to be keep one eye on Canada at all times if you're trying to do business in that part of the world. Do I have that right, Jim?
Oh yeah, especially up in this corner where, you know, Kingdom Trails is the main economic driver of the mountain bike trail network, and half of the visitors are from Canada. So, you know, that's a big chunk.
Well, that is, and so just is your understanding, Jim, that is the border going to open as of July 1st then? Is that the idea, or do we know?
Yeah, I've heard nothing, so that's
okay.
It's a big question for us.
I might have to do a segment on what's happening with the northern border sometime later in the week to really spell out what are these situations, because, I mean, obviously, a lot of Vermonters like to head up to Montreal and elsewhere in north of the border in this time of year, and a lot of folks from up there come down and normally visit Vermont in the summertime. So
actually like on the path from the Boston population that goes up to Canada for a visit. You know, we're a stopover area because we're halfway.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The border is really important for this part of the state.
Right, right. And Willie Doctor at the Moose Meadow Lodge, I'm wondering, let me get your general thoughts about, do you think that the response to the coronavirus crisis by, you know, the public health officials in Vermont and its impact on your industry, do you think it's been reasonable? Do you think it's been overdone? Do you think it's been about... about right, or do you have any sense that way?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I have very mixed feelings about the governor's response. I really appreciate the fact that he and I love Dr. Levine. I'm glad he's part of the team. He's giving us real facts, and I'm glad that the governor's basing his decisions on facts. But as a business person, that turn of the spigot for my case is a little too slow and a little too vague. Every week when he comes out with a little turn of the spigot, we need more clarification on what that means. We then have to interpret that what it means for our business. You know, we have people in the books. Are they qualified to stay here? Or do I have to call them and say, I'm sorry, we have to cancel you? Or, you know, every week, every turn of the spigot leads to a different answer when a guest calls and says, can I stay there? Can I have a wedding there? Can I have a birthday party? Can I have an anniversary celebration? So for me personally, that turn of the spigot's a little too slow, and I'd appreciate a little more advance notice. So in 2 weeks, this is what's going to happen, you know, and not this is what's going to happen in 2 days.
Yeah, I'm going to chime in on that one as well.
Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
I agree with Willie 100%. The number one issue I have is, you know, when the spigot gets turned on more is a timing situation. What the requirements are for that particular new turn, they should be telling us what those requirements are further in advance. For instance, we found out a week and a half ago, we could do outdoor dining. Because a big part of ours is not just the lodging, it's also the restaurant end. And we found out via an email, I think at 6:30 on a Wednesday night, we could open on Friday, and what the parameters were. Well, it would have been nice to know a week before that what the parameters were, so we could at least start physically changing our plant, even if we didn't know the exact date we were going to open. And the same thing pretty much just happened with the indoor dining scheme that just came out on Friday for us to open today. So parameters, I would think they have the parameters worked out. They just don't have the exact date. So let the businesses know what the parameters are.
Interesting thoughts there. It's not really my job to defend these public officials or elected officials or you know, any part of the state team. I would just have to ask you, do you think that given that this is the first time any of us and any of them have been through something like this, you know, in the history of the state and the history of the country, maybe the world, and, you know, certainly we've never had a pandemic like this, certainly not in times of, you know, when our economy normally works the way it normally works in this modern world here. Do you give a little, I don't know, a little leeway just in terms of the whole shakedown cruise aspect of the thing?
No, I certainly agree. This is the first time. This is craziness, you know, 101. But there are other states that have opened way before us, and they've set kind of precedents for how things go. You know, how far apart are your tables? You know, what's your capacity going to be? There's other states that have been doing it for weeks now. So whatever the team is that's putting together the parameters, I would think they're using that and as some of their basis. So, yes, I agree. This is craziness, and it's first time, and, you know, we certainly have to be somewhat understanding. But still, I just think that some of the stuff that just came out should have, at least the businesses should have been told beforehand, even a week beforehand, even 4 days beforehand, would have been helpful for us to restructure the facility.
I got to say I sympathize with my fellow members of the media who are trying to keep up week to week with what all the different changes in the rules are and that sort of thing. But one thing I had a couple of folks, restaurateurs on the show a couple of weeks ago who were talking about when they are finally permitted to reopen the reductions in capacity, you know, just by they thought they were going to need to be spacing tables farther apart and so on and so forth. And given the historically thin margins in the restaurant industry, to begin with, you know, they were really worried about, are they going to be able to operate in this new world? What do you think about that from the restaurant end of your business, Jim?
Yeah, well, we can't. We will not. We'll be able to do it for the next couple of weeks because we are utilizing the PPP money to help keep our labor costs down. But once the PPP runs out, there's no way our restaurant can run with an indoor capacity of 11 people. And that's what we would be at. And that's where we're at right now for tomorrow when we open tomorrow.
An indoor capacity of 11 people.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, and actually we can have 13, but you have to count your floor staff as well. So if, you know, a host or a wait person, to subtract that from the number. And there's just something, you know, logic. It's hard to work logic into the rules. But, you know, like our place here, we have five different dining spaces, like dining rooms. They're independent. People, six people in one room have no contact with the six people in the other room, but we can't look at it that way. We are restricted to 25% of what our approved number of diners is.
Do you think if those strictures last, are you going to have to close?
If those last, we would definitely have to close. There's no way we can run a restaurant on that number of people. Mm.
Willie Doctorow, you don't have a restaurant there, do you?
No, we're strictly a bed and breakfast.
Okay. You do serve breakfast as a meal, but not dinner.
We do.
So, yeah.
Yes, we do serve breakfast, and, you know, we're trying to figure out ways to separate parties. I think we're allowed now to serve them indoors. Last week it was only outdoors or in the room. And, you know, we had a hot tub breakdown, and so we had this empty space in the basement now where we put a card table, and that may end up to be a temporary dining area, which is totally separate from the our regular dining room upstairs. So, and that's the other thing. Because of the fact that we have to be closed, we're postponing some major expenses. We've got some structural repairs that need to be done to the front of the house. We've got equipment that needs to be replaced, including a hot tub. So we have to postpone these things until we get a little more cash in the bank. So it's another example of, you know, the challenges we have to face.
And also the ripple effect throughout the rest of the economy. I mean, that's another. I mean, the local hot tub dealer is not doing that piece of business right now, right?
Right. Right.
Amy Spear, what are you hearing about the are folks in the industry more broadly going to be able to come back, bounce back? Is there going to be some percentage of attrition? And what can you tell us about that?
So we know that the long term, we're not sure what the long-term effects are going to be of restricted travel and business operations for the tourism sector yet, but we know that it's been devastating for folks. And you know, there have been, you know, the Vermont Chamber is the state affiliate for American Hotel and Lodging Association and the National Restaurant Association. And both of those national entities are reporting that, you know, we could see a significant drop in businesses. There could be 10% of businesses of, you know, restaurants, for example, that close, you know, and this is one of the reasons why, because we don't know the long-term effects and, you know, cash flow has been so restricted for lodging properties, you know, the Vermont Chamber has been advocating that we really do need immediate relief in the form of grants via the federal relief package, the $1.25 billion that came to the state of Vermont to help mitigate the economic downturn that we're dealing with. This, I think you've heard from both other folks on the phone today, that this is the time of year when people do rely on deposits for future stays, and that's been restricted, and that's going to have negative long-term impacts for Vermont tourism businesses.
A lot of folks are speculating, and I guess with some scientific reason, about a possible uptick in the fall of the coronavirus. And I know the fall is a huge, that's really a huge tourism time in Vermont. That's got to be scary. Willie Doctor, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I talked to other innkeepers in our area, and we're all afraid of reopening. We're all afraid of also going under. But we're working hard to come up with procedures that will try to mitigate this disease. You know, there's a group of us in the Mad River Valley Chamber of Commerce that's coming up with procedures for laundry, for food service, for public spaces, and for check-in.
Yep.
You know, we're
Think about. Unfortunately, we are running out of time, though, so I'm going to have to interrupt and cut you off there. But my three guests have been Amy Spear of the Vermont Chamber of Commerce, Jim O'Reilly of the Wildflower Inn in Lindenville, Willie Doctor of the Moose Meadow Lodge in Duxbury. The three of you, excellent guests. I wish you luck. I really hope that you guys can figure out a way forward here. This is tough times, and just wanted to give you a chance to come on and talk about it a little bit, and I appreciate you doing so. Alrighty, that's about it for the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM for this Monday. Stay tuned now for the Governor's News Conference, the Governor and other top state officials' latest briefing on the coronavirus. Have a good afternoon, folks. We'll all talk tomorrow morning.